started. Good evening, everybody. I know an awful lot of people in the room, but just in case there's some that I don't know, I'm Christine Chinkin, and I'm a professorial research fellow at the London School of Economics and the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. And welcome is the first task to say to all of you, and particularly it's great to see new friends, old friends, and lots of different people here. We're having tonight the occasion, what does a gender perspective bring to crimes against humanity and genocide, hosted by the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. And a very special welcome to the UK, to both of our speakers, who both travelled a long way and to be here tonight, Patricia Vissa-Sellers and Raja Krishnan.
Yeah,
okay, I've been practicing the second name, but I'll welcome both of them properly in just a moment. It's a special evening for us at the centre, and in particular with respect to the project on gendered peace, because this is the first official public event from the project. A number of my team are here in the front row, and something that we've been working on for a few months, but now, say, having a public event around it. It's a project that is funded by an advance grant of the European Research Council and hosted in the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. So what the project is doing is asking what might be, what is understood by the concept of a gendered peace within the framework of public international law. So as an international lawyer, I mean, this is just a sort of side comment, I'm always amazed that international law doesn't have a concept of peace or a definition of peace. International peace and security, you know, it's all over the UN Charter, it's all over the textbooks on international law and so on. But then lots of definitions of aggression and of war and of conflict and international law. You know, you can go on and on and on. Peace. Nowhere is there a definition at all. So what we are trying to do is think about, well, what might be the components under international law of such a concept of peace, and a peace that is truly gendered. And so we're sort of looking at a number of particular projects within this, relating to areas of international law, in particular women and weapons, disarmament, issues relating to migration, displacement, clearly, of course, a human rights framework across all of it, to try and think about what might be a conceptual understanding of peace, both, and how does this play out, both in response to armed conflict, but also irrespective of whether there's a conflict or not. Do we always have to think of peace as in contradistinction to conflict, or can't we think of peace more generally, which again is something that international law doesn't think about? So that's the project, and this is the first public event of the project. But before we go any further, all the usual formalities, silence phones please. If you want to tweet, there is a hashtag, which may or may not be, yes it is on there, hashtag on LSE gendered peace. The event is being recorded and the audio recording will be available in a few days' time. Okay, so I'll turn now to introduce our two speakers, and I think you'll agree that I don't think there's anybody more qualified than these two to talk about issues relating to gender and international criminal law. So on my right is Patricia Vissa-Sellers. She's an international criminal lawyer par excellence, I think would be the fair way of saying it. She's currently special advisor for gender of the Office of the Prosecutor of the ICC International Criminal Court. She's a visiting professor here at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, visiting professor in practice, sorry, here at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. She's a visiting fellow at Kellogg College of the University of Oxford, where she teaches international criminal law, human rights law, legal advisor for gender, acting head of the legal advisory section, and a prosecutor at the former tribunal for Yugoslavia. And I think that, you know, people who study international criminal law, particularly if they study gender and international criminal law, know that she was the driving force behind the prosecutions in the cases that we all know, Akayesu, Kunaratz, from Rinsicher, and that was very much part of you. You've been advising governments, international institutions, civil society. I could go on. But what Paddy is going to address in particular tonight is the gender perspective, well, the question here, but a gender perspective in the context of crimes against humanity.
Genocide. And then
you're doing crimes against humanity.
Oh, really? I can switch.
Well, you're doing genocide.
I am.
Okay, Akhila Radham Krishna, is also incredibly well qualified from the, again, a very broad context of international criminal law, and is president particularly of the Global Justice Centre, and directs the Global Justice Centre's strategies and efforts to establish legal precedents protecting human rights and ensuring gender equality. And in 2010, you helped to conceptualise the Gender Justice Centre's Abortion Access and Conflict Programme, to, as many of you know, highly topical and controversial issue, but to ensure access to abortion services for women and girls raped in war as a matter of their right and human rights. So numerous shadow reports, numerous legal briefs, advocacy documents, a whole range of different forms of providing legal expertise around these issues to policymakers, to lawyers, in a very wide access. So, let's talk about how, and you were also at the ICTY.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. At the same time?
No. And on defence.
Okay, so each of the speakers will speak for about 20 minutes, and then they'll have a bit of a discussion between themselves, and then we'll open it up to the audience.
Okay.
So, are you okay on crimes against humanity?
Yeah, I'm going to make it okay. can I stand up over
absolutely.
There?
Right.
Well, at first I wanted to stand up over here because I was going to read about genocide, and the print was too small, and so it's better if I stood up and looked up. But what I wanted to do is bring forward then my answer in the most precise and yet the most general way of what is the gender perspective on crimes against humanity or genocide? What does gender give us in terms of crimes against humanity? And my answer is everything. Gender and a feminist critique of international criminal law returns us to the very doctrinal basis for why those laws were set forward. Well, what does that mean? That sounds like a nice fancy thing that might be able to start a dissertation topic, or that I can start talking to the professor and let them go on for at least 5 minutes of thinking I have a point. But I would like to really underscore and outline that point. If one were to talk about, let's say, the gender jurisprudence, you can look at a gender jurisprudence from a very narrow perspective. Let's just count how many sexual assault crimes I'm going to be charging against an accused or I'm going to be defending. Or you could look at it from a much broader point. What is the gendered nature of the facts that I'm looking at? And what is the gendered nature of the very crime that I might be bringing or defending against? So we have what I call a narrow perspective of the gender jurisprudence, or a panoramic perspective of the gendered jurisprudence. And when one looks at either the narrow or the panoramic perspective, one can look at the crimes, such as crimes against humanity, from that perspective. What do you mean? Well, under crimes against humanity, under customary law, but also under the Rome Statute, I could just go and say, well, customary law, we know good and well that rape is a crime against humanity. So let's say, well, what does rape give us from a narrow perspective in terms of being a crime against humanity? Well, the first thing it gives us, it allows us to understand that if a crime against humanity is an attack against the civilian population must be able to be attacked via rape. I mean, it's just a no-brainer. It's not that the rape is there because we're bowing down to politically correct feminists who will be screaming at us if we don't charge rape. It's an acknowledgement that the civilian population can be attacked as part of a widespread or systematic attack by acts of rape. It allows a crime against humanity actually to exist in a much fuller stance by understanding what is the nature of rape during widespread attacks against the civilian population. In its narrowest, most explicit concept, rape is a means by which the civilian population is attacked. In a much broader and a more panoramic aspect of looking at crimes against humanity, I would be led to really saying, well, what is the civilian population? Who is the civilian population? Who is in the civilian population? And I would have to be left with the understanding that the civilian population is composed of human beings. Only human beings can be part of a population. So who are those human beings? Well, they would probably be males and females, adults and children, but they must be human beings, possibly on the entire gender spectrum of which human beings exist, right? And they must also be somewhere in a relationship to each other. You can't have a population of one. One can represent a population, but you can't have a population of one. Well, to look at the civilian population from that perspective, one needs a feminist critique of international law. So the panoramic view allows us to understand that the very nature of the civilian population is a nature that consists of intersectionalities, not only of sexes and identity and gender spectrums, but those persons in relationship to each other in order to create a population. So how does one attack a population? We've already said, for example, by rape. But a feminist critique of saying, well, that attack has to be widespread or systematic, makes us say, well, widespread or systematic against whom? Our feminist critique of who is the civilian population. So what could be a widespread attack against this population? Well, now understanding that the population consists of children or adults or persons who might be LGBTI or trans or older population, then we understand, well, how is it attacked by an underlying act that's widespread? So one could look at the pervasive discrimination against old females within the civilian population and ask yourself, is this an attack against the civilian population as carried out by the attack on older females? And one could do the same with children, and particularly boy children. Maybe when boy children are recruited into armies and they don't lose their status as civilians, and within these armies, they are tortured, imprisoned, or killed, or raped, that might be an attack against the civilian population via young boys. Well, we could look at an attack just from a systematic point of view, because we could be widespread or systematic in order to have a crime against humanity. Well, what types of systems are put in place that could attack a civilian population? We often look at war, but I'm going to give you an example that exists whether it's in war or whether it's in quotes, peacetime, but we will question the notion of peace. Detention centers. Detention centers that during wartime often hold enemy populations, whether they be soldiers that we'll think of as male, but soldiers could be male or female, whether they be soldiers that are adults or children. And during times of non-armed conflict, detention centers, possibly the US detention center, and its extreme high rate of incarceration of poor and usually non-white, Latino and African American sections of the population. Well, since we all agree now that the population can have so many different characteristics as long as it's a civilian population, and we know that the population can be attacked in various means, and one of the provisions under crimes against humanity is imprisonment. To imprison the civilian population as part of an attack against that population. But what about widespread or systematic? I'm going to drop widespread, because systematic can mean that it's based upon policies. It's based upon an organization. Are there policies that are in place that lead to the imprisonment of this civilian population in a means that would be illegal, that would be an attack? Now, I know we don't normally look at our everyday lives in this way, but crimes against humanity, when a feminist perspective is applied, underscores that this is not a crime that's only related to armed conflict. It occurs in time periods when there is not armed conflict. It doesn't have to have an armed conflict nexus. The question is, does it have a peace nexus? Do we recognize crimes against humanity when we're supposedly in peaceful times? Well, I think now, particularly what the center is doing, is we're trying to have a feminist critique of what is peace. Because this crime can be used irrespective of the characterization of the peace or of the armed conflict. Well, let me get back to more of a feminist critique of crimes against humanity. The reason crimes against humanity has become so controversial, one would say, well, you know, it's just changing all the time. After Nuremberg and Tokyo, crimes against humanity existed. Prior to that, the very notion of crimes against humanity was so contested that after World War I, the United States said, well, you know, sounds like an interesting notion to me. Maybe the Martin's Clause gives you a little bit of oomph, but the crime doesn't exist, I'm sorry. And nullum crimen sine lege, you can't prosecute a crime that doesn't exist. Well, the U.S. was bold enough to write that down in the Commission of Experts report. Japan, not being quite as bold, just basically said in a couple of paragraphs, I think they're right. So Japan didn't believe in a crime against humanity either. But between the Tokyo Charter and the London Charter, crimes against humanity becomes recognized and is prosecuted at these two tribunals, but also in tens and tens of subsequent trials, both in Asia and in Europe, and in Control Council number 10. But the crimes against humanity is fairly limited. When you look back at the one in Tokyo and in the London Charter, it does not have rape listed as a crime against humanity. But within a couple years, under Control Council number 10, the subsequent trials that occur after Nuremberg, rape appears as a crime against humanity. And another crime appears that wasn't at Nuremberg and Tokyo. You know which one it is? Torture. Everyone said, well, how'd you leave torture out? Well, torture wasn't part of crimes against humanity until the subsequent trials. And one of the reasons that crimes against humanity has been one of my favorite crimes is that it kind of grows organically. The ideal is understanding how is a civilian population attacked. And so that when you get the Yugoslav tribunal, but when you had the trials of Bangladesh in the 1970s, rape is certainly considered part of crimes against humanity, becomes part of customary law. But the issue is that crimes against humanity is not tied to a treaty or a convention. There is no one treaty of crimes against humanity like we might have with genocide or the Geneva Conventions. By the time you get to the Rome Statute, where crimes against humanity is incorporated, crimes against humanity has grown again, and particularly in terms of the sexual violence acts that could be included now. So we have sexual violence, sexual slavery, forced pregnancy. There goes crimes against humanity kind of organically evolving and agreeing to be placed in there because that's a way you can attack the civilian population. Two other aspects of crimes against humanity that went in were apartheid, was considered a crime against humanity now under the Rome Statute, as well as forced disappearances. That's because of our experience in Latin America during the 80s and the 90s, where forced disappearances was a way to do what? This is when you're supposed to say, attack the civilian population. So it goes in. So how do we come back and look at this gendered perspective from, I think, the feminist critical examination of international law? We have to look at every underlying act, not just the population, the civilian population. How is apartheid carried out against genders? You know, there have been no apartheid prosecutions under crimes against humanity. My understanding, there's been no apartheid prosecutions in South Africa. But if apartheid is a crime against humanity, and we understand how the civilian population that was under an apartheid regime was attacked, not to place a feminist lens on that attack. Simply, it's not to reach possibly 90% of the crime against humanity. The same way with disappearances. We tend to think of disappearances as having happened to men who went to prison in Argentina or in Chile. But women went to prison. Women went to prison who were pregnant. Women went to prison who were pregnant and had children. And those children disappeared. If we don't do a gendered analysis of the disappearance, we're actually losing part of the crime against humanity that occurred. So I will conclude my remarks because I think the answer I gave to the professor in the beginning was absolutely fine. What does a feminist critical perspective do for us in terms of international crime, of crimes against humanity? It brings us back to the core of that crime, to the underlying policy reason of why that crime is in place. And as we move forward now, and crimes against humanity will probably become a treaty within the next 3 to 5 years, we have to understand that that treaty is for the civilian population. And who constitutes the civilian population? And what are the underlying acts? For example, under persecution starts out with only being able to come against a racial group, a national group, or a political group, because of factual occurrences during World War II. But now when we think of persecution under the Rome Statute, some of the groups have been enlarged, and gender is one of the groups that persecution can be based upon. Well, that seems to be fine, but there are groups that still are not included in persecution. And you wouldn't believe which groups. Homosexuals, LGBTI, and what's strange about that is that's how persecution starts in Nazi Germany, with homosexuals and with political groups. And the second way that persecution starts after before World War II, is with the mentally disabled and the physically feeble. That's who the Germans persecuted first and eliminated. But those two groups, homosexuals, LGBTI, and disability groups, are not currently in the crimes against humanity, either proposed statute, either in the Rome Statute, or under customary law. So we might win and lose, but a feminist critique would say, well, our analysis should be, do we have disabled persons that we can look at from a gendered perspective? Are disabled persons part of the civilian population? Is there a widespread means or a systemic means in which they can be attacked? Then they need to join crimes against humanity. They need to bring crimes against humanity back to its core, because that's the very rationale and reason that we're even talking about this crime. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patty, for bringing us back to the core of the crime, and I think reminding us about the policy that we tend to, as lawyers, we often forget about the underlying policy. We think about the definition.
Yes.
Without going, right to what is it we're trying to achieve by having this legal concept in the first place. So, Akila.
Okay. Actually, I might just stay seated. Yeah.
It's up to you. Yeah.
Sure, why not? So, thanks so much. And first, I just want to say that it's such an honor to be on a panel with the two of you. As a young lawyer, beginning my work in this sphere, reading the work that you've done around feminist critiques of international law and all of Patty's amazing work in forging the precedents on, how to utilize gender and feminist strategies in international criminal law has been such an inspiration. So just thank you so much for including me. To follow up on what Patty's point is, I think that I have a similar answer. Gender and genocide have everything to do with each other. So in 2014 and 2015, our organization started working on the Yazidi genocide. And one of the things, if you look at what happened during the Yazidi genocide, was there was this kind of initial influx of the killing of men and adolescent boys. And then thousands of Yazidi women were kidnapped. They were taken into sexual slavery, sold to ISIS fighters, held in captivity. And we're an organization that works and advocates around justice and accountability for gender-based violence. And we work at the UN Security Council. We work on the Women, Peace, and Security Mandate. And we were looking to see, okay, well, the, you know, there's clearly some hallmarks of what looks like genocide that's happening here against the Yazidi. How can we utilize the Genocide Convention, the really strong legal obligations? We think of genocide as the crime of crimes. It kind of, for no reason, gets put up here over crimes against humanity and war crimes, but it has strong legal obligations to prevent it and punish it, and states are supposed to do something in face of it. So we started looking at, okay, how do we look at a gendered perspective on the Genocide Convention, which was written and largely formed by conceptions of the Holocaust, and maybe a little bit around the Armenian Genocide. There was no gender perspective, much like when the Geneva Conventions were written in 1949. We didn't really understand the gendered manners in which war was conducted. And I think similarly here. And so starting with that work, and then actually building on work we started to do around the Rohingya Genocide, we realized that there's been a lot of writing around the prosecutions themselves of genocide, or perhaps the cases that have set the precedents. Akiyesu, for example, is sometimes where a conversation, it feels like, begins and ends. But for most people, genocide is a crime of mass killing. Most people think only of killing, and that's why we actually called our paper Beyond Killing. And we looked at the construct of obligations under international law, the duty to prevent genocide, the duty to suppress genocide, the duty to punish genocide, and what would that require and look like if you put a feminist angle and a feminist perspective on it. So that's kind of where our work has come from. And so to take a little bit of a step back, right, so if genocide isn't the mass killing of populations, then what are the kinds of things that we can look at that'll help us understand genocide and the conduct of genocide from a gendered perspective? And so, I mean, as a starting point, right, genocide is about the destruction of a group. And oftentimes we think of the physical destruction of a group as it sits in the moment. But it's also about the destruction of the regenerative capacity of the group, the ability of the group to continue, the reproductive capacity of the group. And that in and of itself should be a hint that perhaps there's a gendered component to what we're talking about and thinking about there, right? It's not just about killing then. And, you know, when you look at the Genocide Convention, you have 5 crimes that make up genocide. You don't have a crime of killing. You have 4 other crimes that are non-lethal crimes that actually are in the convention. They have, in some ways, at different levels, been prosecuted or not prosecuted, and we can get into that or not. But so how does this inform, then, the responses to genocide, right? And so looking at it, you know, we looked at kind of the broad range of genocides, and some of the top line things that we saw was that female and male members of targeted groups, and often by the design of the perpetrators, experience genocide in distinct ways. So men and older boys are targeted as a role, well, in both contexts, the gender and the roles they occupy in a society actually define how it is that they're targeted. So men and older boys are targeted of the roles they inhabit as heads of households, as leaders, as religious authorities, protectors, combatants, guardians of a group's identity, and as patriarch. And on the other hand, women are often targeted because of their roles or their perceived roles as mothers, as wives, daughters, bearers of future life, keepers of community and family honor, which I think is an enormous one in this context, and sources of labor. And so really an understanding of what it is to be male or female in a society really actually does inform the ways in which genocide against a particular group is carried out. And, you know, one thing that I think we're in a group of people who are not afraid of words like patriarchy and misogyny here, which working at the Security Council, then you just become, you know, the person who's ranting at them. But the, you know, violence that's directed at women during genocide is fed by existing misogynistic attitudes in a society and patriarchal attitudes, both within perhaps a community at large, but within the protected groups oftentimes itself too. And the impact of genocide is magnified by the financial, social, and cultural inequalities of women and girls. And so it's, I think, knowing that and then also looking and seeing that we still think of genocide as something that's committed mostly through killing is one of the places where it really should be a call to action to rethink and bring a progressive feminist approach to this convention Because here's the other thing. In the last few, in the last few years alone, the Genocide Convention on the whole is a failure as a convention, right? It has not really been utilized to effectively prevent genocide in any context. Just in the last 2 years, the 5 years that we've worked on, the Yazidi and the Rohingya genocides are perfect examples of the failure of the convention to actually be deployed and utilized in manners that are useful. So I'm going to skip through some of this stuff. So I'll go a little bit into kind of the five acts of genocide and some of the ways in which that we could take a gendered perspective on what each of these are, right? So as I mentioned, killing is one of them, but the others are causing serious bodily and mental harm, deliberately inflicting upon the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction, imposing measures intended to prevent births within a group, and forcibly transferring children of a group from one to another. And each one of those can be looked at and understood in a gendered manner. So let's start with killing. In genocides, oftentimes the killing, early on in particular, is that of men and boys. But that in and of itself is something that's gendered, right? The disproportionate impact and the killing of men and boys goes back to what I talked about the roles they occupy in society. Why are you going in and killing them? It's because they're the ones that you see as the holders of the identity, as the people who could fight back in a community. It has everything to do with their roles. And in another context, women and girls are, of course, also killed during genocide. And oftentimes the manner in which they're killed is deeply gendered. During the Yazidi genocide, while women of childbearing age were kind of separated and enslaved, older women who were past reproductive age were killed along with the men and the boys. In the Rwandan and Rohingya genocides, sexual violence was utilized often as a precursor to killing, and sexual violence and mutilation were oftentimes a part of killing as well, especially targeting reproductive organs. Mutilation of vaginas, of breasts, was something that was found in many of these contexts. In the Rohingya genocide, it's probably a little graphic, but they found that one of the ways in which women were killed is they were slaughtered with these long swords and knives that were actually meant to be used for slaughtering animals. Or they were, after the men and the boys were predominantly killed, they were put inside their homes and they were burned alive as objects within a home. And so, even the act of killing is something that we should think about that has gendered implications and what that means to make sure that you're properly characterizing the experiences of genocide. Serious bodily and mental harm is the one that I think we know the most about, or we think the most about, when it comes to genocide, largely due to the amazing precedent in Akiyesu, which Patty worked on, which actually for the first time found that rape and sexual violence can be constitutive acts of genocide. But it's not limited to that. And I think it's also important to note that the gendered impact of anything in these contexts is not limited to women's experiences of sexual violence, even while sexual violence is perhaps the most prevalent disproportionate act that women and girls suffer. So in this context, it can also include diverse forms of torture, deportation, enslavement, forcible transfer. And so in the context of sexual violence, for example, you found that sexual violence was a component of nearly every one of the genocides that we've seen happen, starting with Armenia. It was there in the Holocaust, even if we don't talk about it as often as we should. In the Rohingya genocide, for example, they found that 52% of women reported either being a victim of sexual violence or seeing an act of sexual violence being carried out. One thing that is striking is that sexual violence as a tactic in genocides is particularly effective when employed in strongly patriarchal cultures, where, for example, the protection of female members of a group is believed to be the ultimate responsibility of male relatives, right? So sexual violence against a group is understood as a deliberate attack on the group's men, and specifically the gender roles that we perceive men to play. Thinking outside of sexual violence as acts that can cause serious mental harm that are also gendered. Torture, acts forcing female members of a targeted group to watch, or in some cases in Rwanda, murder their male relatives, their own sons. The mental anguish that was caused to Yazidi mothers whose children were whose daughters were taken and sold into ISIS slavery, or whose sons were taken and forced to convert to Islam and participate as ISIS fighters. You know, those are all also part of the broader conception of the serious bodily and mental harm and that has gendered impacts. Similarly, the Third Constitutive Act, inflicting conditions of life, you know, this is kind of, in Akiyesu, they defined it as subjecting a group of people to a subsistence diet, systematic expulsion from homes, reduction of essential medical services below a minimum requirement. You know, this was very much of a crime that was a reflection of what you saw as the conditions in Nazi concentration camps. I think that was the impetus for the definition of the crime. However, you know, this, like everything else, can be seen in a gendered perspective. So, for example, Yazidi women who were held in ISIS captivity, they were kept in locked rooms with inadequate food, water, light, heating, medical care. And so when we think about what was the act of genocide that perhaps happened to enslaved Yazidi women and girls, we think about the systematic sexual slavery and rape that they were subject to, but the conditions that they were kept in can also be a constitutive act of genocide. You know, the fourth act is a really interesting one because it's the act of imposing measures intended to prevent births. And it's one where everyone immediately presumes that this is about women and girls because we see women as wombs, we see women as reproductive agents, and we don't see men in those same lights or in those same capacities. So, you know, some of the acts that can constitute what preventing births is, and incidentally, this is a crime, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, it has never been prosecuted. It's been, Akiyesu had indications on what could be measures, but I don't actually believe that anyone has been prosecuted for this crime.
You brought up briefly in some of the Srebrenica cases. But
okay.
I'll get back to
that. Oh, in the separation, right? But
that,
yeah.
That specific one was also.
Okay. That's helpful. Right. Okay. Yeah, so this can include, you know, forced sterilization, forced birth control, forced abortion. It can also include separation of the sexes. And so when you look at it, right, we assume that the victim is female, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the victim has to be female for this act. So looking at a patrilineal society where ethnic and religious identity of a child is passed down from a father, the very act of separating men from women, a separation that can be made permanent if they're subsequently killed, constitutes a measure to prevent births within a group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for much of the history, it really has not been looked at this way. It underscores that men and boys are not considered reproductive agents in the same way that women are, rather they're bearers of identity. And the final constitutive act is, how much time do I have? I think
five
I feel.
Minutes.
Okay, great. Is forcibly transferring children. And children is a group where oftentimes children are not gendered. They are treated as one group. But, you know, girls and boys experience these acts in very different ways. And so we can look back at the Yazidi example again, where young boys that were taken into ISIS, they were forced to convert. They were forced to become fighters. Young women were held as slaves, and if they were quite young, some of them were used for forced labor, for example, within homes, rather than perhaps be treated to sexual slavery. So again, there needs to be a gendered component, because I think in the context of children in particular, we rarely look at the gendered implications. We've seen it play out in other places, like in the Lubanga case at the ICC, where we really only reflected in the charges and in the subsequent judgment what happened to boys and not necessarily what happened to girls. So that's kind of a roundup of, you know, the diverse ways in which gender informs the commission of genocide, right? So what does this need to mean when we have strong duties to prevent genocide and to punish genocide? So not just necessarily about the prosecutions or the prosecutorial strategies themselves, but taking it up to, if states have a duty to prevent, what do they need to do in face of it? And you know, the duty to prevent genocide is a really interesting one, because states really like to pretend that as long as they don't say the word genocide, they don't have a duty to do anything anymore. But really, the duty to prevent kicks off when, as the ICJ found, when you have a serious risk of genocide. But to know of a serious risk of genocide is then that the risk factors, you have to be able to identify where a serious risk is happening. So in the context of the analysis that we did, we looked at some of the major frameworks around risk factors for atrocity prevention and for genocide. And so looking at kind of the, you know, using as an example the UN framework on analysis for atrocity crimes, which came out of the office of the UN Office of the Special Advisor on Genocide. right? It set out 10 common risk factors for genocide and mass atrocities. And it has, you know, a detailed breakdown. However, the risk factors don't break down how different violations may target male and female victims differently. There's no attempt to differentiate how early warning systems might manifest themselves in gendered harms. And, you know, where women are mentioned both times, they're grouped with children. Women and children, the often used phrase, yeah. Exactly. And so when you don't have risk factors that can help you identify what a risk is, how are you supposed to prevent something if you don't even know that it's happening? And this is, again, a place where the Yazidi genocide gives you a very clear example. Right, one of the few actions that was taken in the context of the Yazidi genocide is in August 2014, when members of the Yazidi community fled up to Mount Sinjar. Coalition actors, the US, the British, they came in and actually did do some work to, you know, to help end the siege and allow people to escape. But at the exact same time, women and girls had already been separated from the men who fled. They were being held in centers in Iraq to ready to be transferred to Syria, ready to be transferred to Mosul, where they were then subsequently sold. And to date, not a single state has taken any action to rescue the women, right? The genocide remains ongoing as these women remain in captivity. Thousands of women and girls are still remain missing. But, you know, in the context of, and Patty was in the room and Mary over there was in the room, and we actually had a conversation on, you know, how do you think about responding to genocide in a gendered manner and the counterterrorism framework. And, you know, we talked a lot about what is it that you do? Why is no state saying, let's rescue these women who are subject to ongoing genocide outside of what they did on Sinjar, outside of the counterterrorism mm-hmm. fight against ISIS? They did nothing. And so I think, you know, that's one of the kind of the main pieces that we're really pushing on, is trying to look for how you can better inform these risk factors. Another one that I just want to highlight is that, you know, the duty to prevent isn't just about what's going on when you're immediately faced with a genocide, right? The duty to prevent is one that should be looked at in a continuum of what are you doing as a society to make sure that you don't fall into genocide itself. And as we've discussed, patriarchal structures, misogyny within a community are actually enormous risk factors for genocide. So the duty to prevent, I think we would also argue that requires the tackling of the pre-existing structures that tolerate gender-based violence, gender equality. So amendments to legislation that actually, you know, that inadequately protects women from violence within their communities, whether in peace or outside of conflict or not. And so I think that we also need to think more broadly about it, because if you're constantly thinking about preventing genocide when genocide has already started, I think we've already failed within the framework. And that's where genocide prevention exists as a concept. And finally, I'm just going to round up quickly by saying, similarly with the duty to punish genocide, right? So I'm not talking about the actual prosecution strategies that are employed, but what are the enabling factors around gender that we need to think about in the duty to punish? So this includes enabling laws and legislation. So is genocide and all five acts actually criminalized within a country's potential criminal code, right? Because if it's just killing, or if it's, you know, if all you have is killing and that's the only domestic way that you could prosecute it, are you ever going to be able to have accountability for genocide? The answer is no. And, you know, again, and another, I think, key piece, and people like Patty and Christine, their cases in point of why it's important to have smart women in these places, but what is the gender strategy? What is there in terms of what are states doing to make sure that in complying with their obligations to prevent, they're employing and creating positions for gender advisors? They're requiring gender competence within both their national jurisdictions, but also then in the context of international courts that they're supporting. What does it look like to make sure that there's gender competence there? Because you're going to continue to have impunity for gender-based crimes of genocide if you don't have the structures enabling in the first place. So I think that's the other place that I would kind of round up.
Great. Thank you. Great. For a very quick... very topical discussion about how you take a 1948 convention and apply it both through the gender lens, but also through a contemporary lens as to what's going to happen. Now, this is a rather more informal and perhaps slightly more interactive than some of the events here. So before handing it over to you, let's have a bit of a conversation between the two of you and myself. So, Patty, have you got any immediate responses, or not responses, comments, thoughts, ideas that came to your mind listening to Akila?
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear this analysis, because I think that this is exactly where we should be, and even deeper. So I want to give two comments, and I'm looking for this quote that I was going to present earlier. And this is, but I'm happy that we broaden it. So I'm sure everyone has heard of the Kerstage case, and the Kerstage case is one of the first genocide cases that related to Srebrenica. And I always call Srebrenica kind of like a sub-body of jurisprudence. But in the Kerstage case, in the first case, the judges said, and I quote, "In examining these consequences, the trial chamber properly focused on the likelihood of the community's physical survival. As the trial chamber found that the massacred men amounted to 1/5 of the overall community." So the trial chamber found that given the patriarchal character of the Bosnian Muslim society in Srebrenica, and they use the word patriarch right in the judgment, okay, the destruction of such a sizable number of men would inevitably result in the physical disappearance of the Bosnian Muslim population in Srebrenica. Evidence introduced at trial supported this finding by showing that the majority of men killed, officially listed as missing, their spouses are unable to marry or consequently have children. So the physical destruction of the men, therefore, had severe procreative implications for Srebrenica, and potentially consigning the community to extinction. So, I mean, your main thesis is right there early on in the Kerstage judgment that this genocide was about reducing the reproductive capacity of this population. My question is, why are we still not able to use this jurisprudence as we're looking at the Yazidis, as we're looking at ongoing jurisprudence, and stop being under the impression that we haven't had courts already stating those words, patriarchy, reproductive things, because we need to reinforce that. The latest Karadzic decision did not find the genocidal intent for the detention camps, but it reinforced the genocidal intent and the means and manner that the Srebrenica genocide resulted in reduced reproductive capacity. So I think that we should be able to fortify our analysis of Yazidis by understanding that genocide is about the inability of a group to reproduce. Mm-hmm. That's what the five acts are really leading to. Mm-hmm.
And that is the destruction.
That's the destruction. Yeah. And that is the core of the doctrine. Absolutely. That's the core of the doctrine.
But to build on what you said and where you finished, you used, Akila, at one point the word failure. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And clearly, you know, we, as you said, there's been very few prosecutions under the Genocide Convention. It's an old convention. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And equally, I think, you know, you've just said, why is this not being picked up on again from the quote that you've just said? And quite clearly, the ICC has been a failure in terms of gender crimes, in terms of crimes of sexual violence, in terms of providing a conceptual analysis of crimes against humanity in the way that you've been talking about. So you sort of said, you know, where's the gender strategy of states? Mm-hmm. What do we as feminists do? Where's the feminist gender strategy that we can build on both an old convention and genocide convention and perhaps a new convention with the crimes against humanity?
But do you want to answer that one?
Well, it's actually interesting. It's a little bit of what the work of our organization is because when we talk about women, we're often consigned to CEDAW, right? So what they say when you're working in this space is they go, oh, yeah, go to CEDAW. Like, go to the CEDAW committee. That's where they're going to help you deal with your gender issues. I mean, that's literally what everyone says. I mean, they're trying to kick One Piece Security out of the Security Council.
Trying to ignore CEDAW.
Well, I mean, but that's also why they want to send you there is because then you can ignore the annoying things that are being said out of it. But actually, early on, you talked about the work that we're doing on abortion access and conflict.
Yeah.
And one of the pieces that we did with that project that I think was really important as a matter of right is actually we hooked it to a progressive interpretation of what non-discriminatory care under the Geneva Conventions looks like. So if the Geneva Conventions mandate that everybody is required to receive the medical care that is needed by their condition, and that it cannot be provided on with discrimination on the basis of gender, what can that look like in the context of modern conflict? And so we've actually successfully argued in certain cases, and if you actually look at Secretary General's report, you'll see that there's language that says that access to abortion should be provided in line with international humanitarian law. And it's one of our ways of saying, listen, if these laws are to remain relevant, we need to very strategically start thinking about how we bring a feminist lens to these. And oftentimes you have to get creative with the language of the law in order to try to push states forward around it. And that's what we're doing, you know, with the analysis that we've done is we've also been trying, you know, we've submitted gender analysis of what's happened to the Rohingya and to the Yazidi, to the ICC, you know, trying to push for where those prosecutions are happening to be more holistic and make sure that the gender crimes aren't being left out, to make sure and say, hey, you may not, you know, whatever you're doing, you may not have the capacity in a kind manner to do this full gendered analysis. So we, as feminist lawyers and civil society, we're trying to provide you with the information that hopefully can prompt the type of thinking that needs to happen.
Yes, any other strategies?
Yes, well, one strategy I think would be to have the international community arrest al-Bashir. Because that's I mean, from a feminist point of view, to make sure that he faces genocide as it relates to crimes against females, but also that those crimes could be analyzed, that genocide could be analyzed from a feminist point of view. But I think one of the other things that we have to do, and you know, we have to act in every sphere at every time, to, in quotes, relegate us to CEDAW, is almost detrimental to CEDAW, you know, is making CEDAW act as if, oh, you're a wastebasket to pick up everything every time women talk, as opposed to you're an independent, you're an independent treaty, and that, you know, you should be respected as such. You're not the receptacle. Mm-hmm. I think what I find often to be missing is I think we need some feminist legal historians. I don't know if anyone is willing to occupy that position. I think we need a scholarship or something. And the reason I say that is that international law, and in particular international criminal law, is often built upon custom. And custom is very related to legal history. And if one doesn't really understand legal history, it's very difficult to make your policy arguments based upon custom, or to go against the progressive development of the law that's progressing against you. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that several international criminal lawyers do, and lo and behold, we're surprised, is if one goes back into the transcript of Nuremberg, plenty of sex in there. You know, we only hear about the Russian prosecutor said, oh, you know, you can't hand this up, don't let a woman see this, okay? I mean, there's a lot of sexuality and sexual crimes, including against males and females, within the Nuremberg transcript, not in the judgment. But if you understand the transcript, then you understand in the judgment when they cite to Article 46 of the 1907 Hague Convention, family honor, they're talking about that evidence that they're alluding to in the transcript that didn't make it into the judgment. But one could just look at all the naked bodies when you look at the concentration camps in Nuremberg and say, my God, that's, in the very least, we have forced nudity, in the very least. But what we also have in Nuremberg, if you read closely and into the subsequent trials, we have experiments for sterilization, of course, that were carried out on males and on females. Mm-hmm. Nuremberg is extremely about making sure not so much that the Jewish population didn't reproduce. We were going to kill them out anyway. We have to worry about them reproducing. But they were using those Jewish bodies' sexuality to see how they could limit the reproductive capacity of other groups that they didn't like, after the Jews were wiped out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a very sexual reproductive type of mentality that is present in the camps and gets into some of the transcript if you understand what you're looking at and the subsequent trials, and is reflected back in the judgment. The same thing in a very different way happens with Tokyo. Tell you when, read chapter 8 of the Tokyo judgment, you will stop counting how many times the word rape is put in there. I mean, I've stopped counting at over 150, and the thousands of people who were raped that are in the Tokyo judgment. But the legal historians, feminist legal historians, are not present. And so we have other people writing, such as the history, you know, a very good colleague of mine, I just forgot his name. Rob Corey, he writes about the Tokyo tribunals. I look in the index, how many times you were mentioning rape, you know, mention it two times. No analysis on the sexual assault of Tokyo. Thank goodness that Susanna Sakolda brings out some stuff. But we are missing that vital part in order to fortify customary law and what we're doing going forward now. So the Bangladesh and the Cambodia tribunals had to kind of argue, think rape was a crime against humanity by the 1970s, yes or no, what do you think, I'll give you, that should have been a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, and we keep losing time on that. Bill Schaffes is putting out a new book about 1919. There were feminists who were involved after World War II and discussing different issues that related to whether sexual violence should be prosecuted. So I think we need some feminist legal historians.
So should we have feminist legal historians in the International Law Commission?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we wouldn't be
trying to
fight as hard as we are.
Yeah. Or the Security Council?
Yes.
Last week it was 15 men. I just want to point it out. Yeah, last week when they passed that resolution, I was sitting in the room. 15 male ambassadors.
Talking about reproductive health, right?
Yeah.
Or not.
And sexual, or not. Yeah, and sexual violence.
The case may be. I was going to make an advert at the end of it, but since you both raised CEDAW, I will make the advert now, which is on the 28th of May, the centre is having a celebration of 40 years of CEDAW. I know we all very frequently criticise CEDAW, but what we're asking is, where would women be today without mm-hmm. CEDAW? It is still the foundational basis for an international legal obligation for women's equality.
Right.
And so 28th of May, lunchtime, we're having a member of the CEDAW committee to come and talk about celebrating CEDAW. And then in the afternoon, we've got two panels on different aspects of CEDAW's work, one on the violence against women, the other on holding states to account. Particularly in light of the UK, the concluding comments against the UK that came out last month sometime. So, diary. Yeah, all of you, 28th, 29th of May. Okay, just one last question before I hand it over to everybody else. We've talked about feminist approaches to international law. Obviously, we've talked about feminist approaches to international criminal law. What's any of this got to do with peace and gendered peace? Can analysing and giving a gender lens onto specific areas of international law, such as international criminal law, can that in any way at all help promote peace, and in particular, gendered peace? Or should we say, okay, our launch event doesn't actually advance our themes at all? I'll come to you first.
Okay. Well, look, I think my work has led me to understand that our notion of peace is extremely masculine, that peace occurs when armed conflict has ceased. And that means that therefore, anytime there is no armed conflict, we must be living in a state of peace. But that peace is not a gendered peace. Many people on the gender spectrum and females are not at peace because there's no armed conflict. It's just a different state of disturbance. So I think that in the very least, peace is present when there's a complete absence of human rights violations and humanitarian law violations. So I would be pushing for that, which might seem at the extreme, but I think if we start to look at it that way, then we can start filling in other aspects of how do you consider yourself, when do you consider yourself to be in a peaceful social and political and economic environment. And I would just add one thing, if I can, is that the Security Council's job is not just to maintain the peace, but to look for breaches in the peace, threats for breaches in the peace, restoration of the peace. So if we had a different concept of peace, we'd have to have a different concept of the role of the Security Council.
And as a colleague of mine said, why is it called the Security Council and not the Peace Council?
Right.
Say, Eddie?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that international criminal law helps reveal for us is essentially what are the, you know, if you look at the acts that are happening that we're thinking of prosecuting, kind of taking your framework of the absence of human rights violations, I think then it should help us back into what are the root causes of this violence, right? And that is, and addressing root causes of violence has to be a part of a peace initiative. And there's been plenty of work by smart feminist writers, thinkers, lawyers around concepts of what, you know, the linkages between cultures that are more equal when it comes to gender and in other manners, mm-hmm. and actually the fall into conflict, the speed with which conflict can be resolved, the maintenance of peace in the aftermath of conflict. So I think that like we really should be focused in all of these on not just rectifying, you know, ICL is a very responsive framework, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something happens and you do something to rectify or create accountability for what happened. But if we can also use it as a learning place for then what are the things that we're essentially trying to prevent in the first place, I think that is very much connected to the larger project of peace.
Which is also why your whole discussion about prevention was so important, yes. You know, in that context. Okay. Over to you, and hands going up. So I'll take three or four at a time. We have to finish late by 8 o'clock, but that does give us plenty of time. There's a mic will come round, so can you wait for the mic? Can you keep your questions fairly short and on the point, and say who you are before you begin? So we'll go here, then we'll go there, and then we'll go to the back for the first sort of round. So here.
Hi. Hi, thank you very much for your presentation, very interesting. My name is Matteo Pinto. I am a PhD student here in the law department. And my question is, in your presentation, but also in international law, there is a big taken for granted that the most serious wrongdoings that women can be subject of must be tackled by means of criminal law or criminal punishment, both domestic criminal law and international criminal law. In your opinion, why it is so? Why is this taken for granted, never contested? Because if we stop and think about it, we know that criminal law only focuses on individuals, do not take into account the root causes of wrongdoings, and its operation is often abused by public authorities and used to repress dissent and political opposition. So it's an odious law that should be minimized as much as possible, but for serious wrongdoings that women can be subject of, we think that is the first and the most important way to tackle those
okay,
wrongs.
Okay, so why is criminal law seen as the starting point, really? And I'd add on, and it's seen as a failure if there isn't any sort of criminal law aspect. Great.
Hi, my name is Sapin. I'm a law student. My question is, what would a gendered remedy look like for rights violations? So a right only makes sense if there is an accompanying remedy. So what would a gendered remedy look like? And the context that informing this question is the recent decision by the Yazidi Supreme Council to reject the children of ISIS sex slaves on the condition that they rejected the suggestion by the Iraqi government that they would have to be raised as Muslims, and of course they would reject that. So what happens to those women and those children, and how would that inform our understanding of gendered remedies?
Thank you very much. So a question about gendered remedies, again, picking up on the ISIS example.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name's Natasha. I did a master's here a few years ago.
Hi.
And now work at INGO on advocacy and policy around gender and emergencies and humanitarian settings. So more the sort of, I guess, policy side of women, peace and security, which is where my question comes from in terms of looking at the underlying policy space for a gendered peace, particularly for feminist international lawyers. I'd be really interested to hear from all of you because I feel like perhaps in international law, as in other areas of law, women lawyers or feminist lawyers don't always end up practicing. That might be because the kind of space for international law I feel like is increasingly small, particularly for international criminal law, because of the sort of, you know, I guess, move within the international community to not open up new courts and tribunals. So do you think that some of this feminist legal history that we're looking for is written in policy pieces and advocacy statements and in women's grassroots activism and outside of legal scholarship? Could we then use it to form some of the basis for a literature on gendered peace?
Thank you. I'll take one more in this round. Anybody else at this point? Yes, here.
You can be first in the next round. Okay.
Sorry. My name is Rebecca Savage. I'm actually a student of political science. I really appreciated your conversation about root causes and prevention, and I'm curious about how you treat the fact that people may not know that they are committing a gendered crime, that to them simply a way of life, they're gender blind. How does that inform your work towards the prevention, the root causes, and also the prosecution, the legal conversation regarding it?
Thank you. Right,
Well, let me start with your question about why do we run to the criminal law system? And I mean, I think it's a very valid question. And I think it's, well, first of all, because this conference is about international criminal law. That's why we're talking about it so much. But I think you're talking about more generally, why does that seem to be the response as opposed to, and that's what I'm saying, as opposed to what? Well, I would say that most females, women, or most people don't run to the criminal system. I mean, I think that most sexual violence in national jurisdictions, you know, has a prosecution rate of less than 10%, a win rate of less than 2%. And certainly with the failure of the ICC, it seems to be a continuing history at this point in time with international courts and tribunals. So I would say that, yes, there's a lot of discussion concerning, because we're trying to analyze and understand our international rights in terms of access to justice and using international criminal law and human rights law, but in the vast majority of cases, I mean, if the ICC were performing at top rate, there'd be less than 1% of the harms ever addressed. And when one looks at Rwanda, 500,000 people supposedly killed, or Yugoslavia, what's happening in Zaire, it's really an extremely small percentage that international criminal law interacts with. So I would say the majority of people do not go through these systems, do not look for these systems, and I would say that that also is a case in national courts for harms that occur, and particularly against females.
You have to come in on one or other
questions? Sure. Well, one thing that occurred to me just in kind of all four questions is actually where CEDAW is the perfect framework for addressing the answers to all of the four questions. It's not necessarily the place where it needs to go, but CEDAW starts from a point of addressing and tackling structural gender inequality and having, you know, kind of a transformative component of having substantive equality as the goal that you're going for. So it informs reparations. It informs what access to justice looks like. It informs what needs to happen to a criminal justice system in order to enable it to maybe increase some of those prosecution rates and have women actually report into those systems. So that was just something that, you know, we use CEDAW a lot. And actually, to your point about policy and advocacy, probably in CEDAW shadow reports, in communications to CEDAW, you probably have quite a bit of interesting information that's contained in that space. And we may not think of those as traditional legal documents, but those shadow reports contain a vast array of information around women's experiences and how they should be addressed. And in the context that you asked about the specific question on remedies and what's going on with the spiritual council, so, you know, in Yazidi, the Yazidi community requires that both parents be Yazidi. So that's a little bit at the core of what's going on here with the rejection. So they had the declaration early on by Baba Sheikh that said that women who had been raped by ISIS fighters should be welcomed back into the community, because if you, as a Yazidi woman, have sexual contact with somebody who is not a Yazidi, you get cast out of the community. So that was one step. And here, I think we're actually seeing a little bit of, you know, both a, you know, both one of the inherent structures that exist within a Yazidi community that maybe need to be addressed. This is what I was talking about when you look at the duty to prevent and you address structural inequality. Just because a victim group is a victim group doesn't make it perfect. And, you know, they're not allowing them back because they don't see them as Yazidi, because you need both parents. Women aren't able to convey the identity. The identity of that child is very much rooted in the identity of the father, right? We're really talking about the reason that they're not being accepted is because we don't view the mothers as conveying the identity. And that's something that we see as a problem around the concept of children born of rape more generally. It's not just one that's specific to the Yazidi community. So the address, you know, around reparations there is we need to think about how we change the structures. What are the laws that, you know, we're seeing it with the Rohingya, right, with the children born of rape there. What are the laws that don't prevent women to, on their own, register their children, you know, that require you to be able to list your father? Those are some of the things that we also need to think about in terms of remedy. And, you know, a framework of reparations can include a range of things. My favorite one is guarantees of non-repetition, because it's the one that urges you to look at the structural problems within a society and make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Mm. Would you like to add anything, particularly on either the political spaces or the root causes question?
Well, I think the political spaces, I think your question is very interesting. And yes, policy papers can become part of what one looks to customary law, but there are other ways that one can participate, and in particularly, you, those of you who are law students or still somewhere in your studies or as soon as you get out, where you don't have to go into a court. For example, there's some, maybe it's somewhere very subversive, but there were a group of us feminist lawyers who had a series of meeting about the upcoming Crimes Against Humanity Convention. And we understood that we were allowed to submit commentary to the convention, to the International Law Commission, by December 1st of last year. And so several of us, whether individually or in groups or from human rights clinics, submitted comments or commentaries. Those comments and commentaries are now part of the official UN record, will be part of the travail préparatoire, if a convention is ever had, even if they don't accept what you said. Someone 50 years from now can say, well, look, there was this one commentary provided by this human rights group or this feminist group, and maybe that's how we should start looking at what this provision means. Was it? So yes, those are important things. We shouldn't think that we have to write, you know, the stellar closing brief or amicus curiae. There are many ways to enter and intervene this international human rights and criminal law sphere and be quite valid.
Thank you. Right. Wait for the mic, please.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Leila. I'm a postdoc in criminology at the University of Oxford. I have a question around, so when we talk about international criminal law and also more generally about the women, peace and security agenda, we're usually talking about states and how we can influence them, how we can make them to prevent violence and genocide. And that, of course, in and of itself legitimates states as protective structures, even though they can be as well seen, and I think that includes all states, as structures of violence. And I wonder, especially as we now move on sort of to an agenda of looking at gendered peace, whether we can also think beyond states in the way we do feminist advocacy, because I feel a lot of feminist energies are absorbed by influencing states, going to the Security Council, all these institutions, and I wonder whether there's more space now for looking at alternative forms of law, bottom-up approaches, different ways of thinking about community life beyond the state, essentially, with a gendered peace agenda.
Thanks. Thank you. Other. In front of you.
Hello, my name is Lily Cather. I work for an NGO called European Center for Constitution and Human Rights in Berlin. And my question relates to the definition of feminist and gender. So what kind of feminist do we need to be, or what does our understanding of gender need to include, not to exclude certain groups? For example, if we look at contemporary feminist movements, there are people who call themselves feminists, but they are not anti-racist. They are not supporting people with disabilities, and I'm just very wary of the fact that now we are fighting with a gender perspective to include crimes committed against women, that we really run the risk of then also including, excluding crimes committed against people with disabilities, or, for example, gender non-conforming persons, if we have a very conservative understanding of female and male as to be gender.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very stimulating discussion. This is Veronica Bear from Save the Children. With regard to investigation and prosecution for crimes against children and somehow a deficit of investigation and prosecution punishment for crime of in term of armed conflict. Akila, you were mentioning the issue of children being this sort of homogeneous group where, whether it's boy or girls, 17 years old, 8-year-old or 4-year-old, we're sort of blurry group. Do you think that a feminist approach, I mean, we see there's been nevertheless quite a lot of progress with regard to SGVV and women, peace and security, which there doesn't seem to be as much progress with regard to focusing on the issue of crimes against children and armed conflict. And are there some learnings that can be done by from some feminist approaches to be applied in this context? Thank you.
Okay, so again, maybe we start with you then, Ms. Tanakila. So basically, questions about can we think beyond the state?
Yeah.
And really, the last two are very similar in some ways. Mm-hmm. What does feminism include? What does it encompass? How do we actually understand gender? And I think we could add on, particularly this moment of real backlash against feminism and gender. So,
I mean, I think one place to start with is, as feminists, we're often, you know, groups that are fighting for marginalized minorities, we're often put against each other, right? Mm-hmm. So there's only space for so much gain. There's only space for women to win, so we have to marginalize anti-racist work or LGBTQ. And I think it puts a demand on all of us to really be much more thoughtful and intersectional and really understand that it's not a zero-sum game, and that actually that we're going, we can, it's not a tiny piece of the pie that we should be fighting over. I mean, we see it all the time, right, at the UN. I mean, I can use that stupid resolution from last week as an example of what ended up happening. I mean, there was progressive language around LGBTQI. There was progressive language at one point around sexual and reproductive rights. There was, you know, there was language around children born of rape. There was language around men and boys. And, you know, then it becomes a parsing of each person picks their piece a little bit and starts fighting for the one thing that is really, really important to them. And instead, I think we need to do better in thinking more holistically and not allowing, I think, the structures that want to pit us against each other to actually succeed in pitting us against each other. Mm-hmm. And some of that, I think, Valerie, to your, like, it goes to your question as well around the children armed conflict. Women, peace and security and children armed conflict rarely work that well together as agendas that sit at the council, using that as an example, right? There's people who are advocates for children. There's people who are advocates for women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's different agendas and each person works in one. So, and there's protection of civilians, which kind of sits over here where a lot of the male-based human rights groups are advocating at the council. Women sit here in women, peace, security, and then the children's advocates sit there. And I think it's similarly, I think there's experiences across all of them to be learned. Successes that have existed within the children armed conflict mandate can be brought into the others. And I think, again, it's really working harder to bring the groups together and understand that, you know, we fight for one, we fight for them all. You mentioned all the input into the Crimes Against Humanity Treaty. I mean, around the issues of gender, it was diverse, right? The definition of gender was a main piece that I think was a thread throughout almost every submission that was made, because we all agreed that having that regressive definition of gender that is imported from the Rome Statute would not be a good thing in a new treaty moving forward. And rather than have to fight for a better interpretation, we wanted it out. But, you know, we submitted something on the really terrible enforced pregnancy language that's in there. And it's probably not going to be picked up now, to your point, but hopefully somewhere down the road someone sees it. But, you know, and then you submitted around
slave trade and slavery.
Exactly. And so I think that that's the other piece, too, is to think about how we can bring kind of these endeavors together a little bit more.
Yes, well, I think the two questions are related. We get to, there's a difference for me. Many people can say they're feminists, and I'm not going to say, well, okay, did you meet these 10 criteria, and I'm going to be the judge of whether you're feminist or not, or what is your definition of gender? And maybe we might have slightly different definitions of gender, you know, politically or feminism. But I think that's very different from having a feminist critique of a subject. And a feminist critique of a subject, I think, is per se intersectional. I mean, I think Kimberly Crenshaw says that, you know, we can, a feminist critique does not just look at one aspect of just being a woman, because we have to see, well, you know, what is the race of that woman? What is the ability or disability of that woman? What is the age of that woman? Where is that woman geographically? Even if we just wanted to keep it in quotes to what a woman that you have in your mind, you'd have to intersectionalize that woman. But I think the feminist critique goes much further, and it looks at the intersectional identities around every aspect of anyone who exists on the gender spectrum, whether that incorporates, you know, their cultural religious beliefs. And that feminist critique might be much broader than how that person identifies as a feminist, you know. Everyone on the gender spectrum has a relationship to reproductivity, mm-hmm. you know, and their relationship to reproductivity could be very, in quotes, mainstream, not mainstream. Everyone has a way of gender, you know, preference or presenting. And that's what I think the feminist perspective has brought. So therefore, children fit in per se, you know, until you age out. But then your other age group fits in per se until you age into elderliness, and then that fits in. So I think that that's the wonderful thing about the feminist approach or critique to international criminal law, and I think to other aspects of legal aspects of our life.
And thinking beyond the state, either of you?
Oh, that's a hard one. Well, I would say, in thinking beyond the state, it doesn't, again, it doesn't have to be, and I think we're looking at it slightly from the point of view of, since human rights means the relationship of the individual to the state, then we have to think about the state. I think we can also look at it in terms of this more evolving concept of this, what does sovereignty mean? And usually we would tie sovereignty to the state, but sovereignty really resides with the people. And so that one really has to look at the people, whether it be of the state or of states or of the international community, because we know that states now have obligations for persons who are not necessarily their citizens, and states have obligations in third territories if they have, you know, European law effective control. And we know that states also have obligations that go beyond the generation who are their, in quote, citizens or voters. So I think that we need to sometime look at that framework more so on who holds the sovereignty, and they are the peoples of all the lands of the international community, to break this framework that's just so state-centric. But you can break it to a certain extent, but all of our treaties that are state-based lead us back to it. So then we have to imbibe the treaty body process with the sovereignty of the people, I believe.
And on that, I mean, I think one thing I would just add is this is where, you know, the participation pillar, for example, of Women, Peace, and Security is a way to bring those voices into the spaces where it is about the states,
absolutely.
Right? So thinking about who sits at the table, we know that so much of the important work is being done at the local level, at the grassroots level, yet whoever is informing the policies that are being made, whether it's advocating to states or otherwise, it tends to be people like us who sit at the international community. It tends to be kind of a very specific set of people, and I think that working harder to make sure to lift up those voices and make sure that the experiences are there in then actually creating what laws and policies look like is something that we forget is a really important part of the pursuit of the Women, Peace, and Security, but other parts of the agenda as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings us to 8 o'clock. Thank both of our speakers again, and please join us for further conversation and a drink outside. So if you'll join me in thanking Patty and Akiva.
Did it come off? Did it come off?